Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And with me today is my friend Al Val.
Al Val. That is my name. One of many names that I use.
Yeah.
Aliases.
And one alias is Destination Nightmare, which you are a posting fool.
Yeah, did you see the new King Crimson posting?
Yeah, I was reading that last night. I read the second one last night.
Yeah, I added the third one today. The only reason I did that was because it's a real pain in the butt to get all that information. Because for some reason, Blogger, if you don't get it perfectly in sync the first time, it'll show up real nice on Firefox. But Internet Explorer will not take it. It has to be perfect, first time perfect. So that's why I did it in three sections, because I could only get one right, and then it would be bad. I mean, that second part, I think I redid that seven times, because it would show up on Firefox, but it wouldn't show up on Internet Explorer.
I never thought of that. I've never looked at Internet Explorer to see what.
Well, I never would either. But my friends did, and hey. They would like email me or call me, hey, you know, your blog's down. I go, what do you mean it's down? He goes, yeah, all you get is that one page and nothing else. And I'm like going on there and go, holy crap.
I'm sure people use it. I just don't. In the old days, used to have problems with Netscape and Internet Explorer.
Because
they wouldn't show up correctly.
Yeah, well, it still does. So I actually changed the layout. I took all the pictures out of the left-hand side, just so maybe it'll help with the layout. It won't be that cumbersome, so Internet Explorer won't give me like a conniption fit or whatever. And what you hear is, yes, my mom's car is going off right now.
Wow, that's back in the 80s again.
Yeah, the alarm is going off right now, so there you go. Nothing to worry.
No, I really enjoyed that. Basically, if I wrote that blog, I'd say, I like King Crimson. They rock. And that's as far as I would go on it, you know.
Yeah,
in depth and pretty interesting.
Yeah, my friend Pat is a real. He's the guy who turned me on to prog rock, so he's really hardcore into Crimson or whatever. And an interesting thing about that blog, it's actually turned me on to some comic book artists that I didn't really know a whole lot about. I knew who they were, but I never really knew who they were. I think we talked about it before. Like, one of my favorite artists is now Matt Baker. I love his work. It's like a combination of like Bill Everett and Dave Stevens or something like that. It was like, you know, I'm getting stuff off of Digital Comics Museum because I guess it's public domain. And some of that stuff is beautiful. So I'm going back and, you know, checking out some of the old artists. And like, as soon as I like get more and more like into them or whatever, I'll actually write a longer, you know, piece about them because they really deserve it. I mean, these guys are like the lost dudes in a way of comic books.
That was something I was wanting to ask you because I like the Golden Age, but I just see it in reprints, and unless they were somebody that continued to work, you know, do later work all the way up to the 70s, I didn't really know much about them or who they were. Whenever you and I talk, you could always bring up people like Jesse Marsh, you know, all these that I didn't really know the names or anything else about. And on the blog, I noticed that you're posting stuff I had never seen until I started going to the Digital Comics Museum, the that Frankenstein comic, which you posted.
The Dick Briefer, yeah.
That was wild.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird combination of like horror and cartooniness or whatever, but it really works.
Well, it's something I liked about the Golden Age was it just seemed to me there were so many different kinds of things. Not that I liked all of them, but you had all the Western cowboy comics. You had the adventure comics. You had superheroes. You had funny stuff, which a lot of the funny animal stuff, to me, doesn't look all that good. But it was just all kinds of stuff. Like, they were, half the time I took it, they were just trying to see what would stick on the wall.
Yeah, you know? Exactly, yeah.
But that's the kind of world I like, is where you got everything and not just one thing.
Yeah, because nowadays you do have a little bit of a variety, but, I mean, it's not really mainstream, you know, all the smaller companies are the ones that are doing the odder things or whatever. You know, the big two are just, you know, into like renumbering their books and then canceling them as soon as they possibly can, which you were talking about earlier. Yeah, it's funny that I never got into funny animal books either, you know, but then you're a big Donald Duck fan.
Well, I did like the funny animal comics. I guess a lot of it was, you know, what your friends like, you have a tendency to like too. And I'd always pick up, well, they weren't funny animals, but Richie Rich. Ever since I was a kid, for some odd reason, I'd pick those books up. I liked all the Dell stuff for the Hanna-Barbera cartoons that they would put out. And a lot of times, I would see the comic book before I ever saw the cartoon on TV.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but I always enjoyed it. A lot of my friends collected Harvey Comics, all the Casper stuff and Hot Stuff, you know, which, again, I always liked. I don't think the other, Rook and you and Dallas ever really read any of Harvey Comics.
No, but you know what's weird about Harvey Comics? If you think about it, one of their characters, Casper, is a dead kid.
Yeah.
Wendy is a witch, obviously, you know. Like, Hot Stuff is the devil's son, I would imagine. You know, they're very, very,
well,
it's funny, though, but if you think about it, it's kind of like, well, they were really going off into, like, another, you know, direction, basically.
Well, yeah, but
and then Richie Rich is some kind of capitalist, like a 1%er or something.
Yeah, super rich.
Yeah.
Well,
I know, all
the Halloween stuff you saw as a kid, it was always the ghost, it was always the devil, it was always the witch. I mean...
But then they had, didn't they have like that big kind of like slow character? Was it Baby Huey? Was he like in?
Yeah, he was. I never read those. I remember seeing it. Well, the history of Harvey Comics. I thought they were a comic book company, and then famous studios who did the Popeye cartoons.
Yeah.
I figured they just picked up the comics, you know, and made cartoons out of them. Kind of find out I was wrong. The famous studios created Casper. You know,
as a cartoon?
Yeah, it was a cartoon.
Oh, I didn't know that, man.
And Casper, I'm told, was created by Joe Oriola.
Felix the Cat, one of the Felix the Cat guys.
Well, Felix the Cat was created by a man named Otto Mesmer.
Otto Mesmer, yeah.
Although, I guess John Sullivan owned it and was, you know, he always took credit for creating it.
Right? Yeah, Pat Sullivan, yeah, right.
But it was, I said John Sullivan.
Yeah, it was Pat
Sullivan.
Pat Sullivan. Yeah.
But it was Otto Mesmer. But it was a different Felix the Cat. And then when Mickey Mouse came out, they were, you know, Felix is the biggest cartoon star in the world at the time. And then when Mickey Mouse had sound, that just put everybody out. When he went to color, you know, Felix the Cat kind of vanished. I've seen some old color of Felix the Cat cartoons, and he had a kid's voice. And I guess he was always singing kind of ragtime blues.
You mean from the 30s or 40s
or
something?
Yeah, I guess it was the 30s or 40s.
I know there was a 60s one. I think that was a Joe Oriola one.
That was Joe Oriola. Basically, Joe Oriola got the rights to it and redesigned Felix to the modern-day round Felix the Cat. Gave him the magic bag of tricks and created that fantastic cartoon that I love so much with the professor and Rock Bottom and Vavoom.
Yeah,
I just... One of the greatest... But Joe Oriola was kind of interesting because he seemed like he was a good artist and designer and created stuff, but he was really good at grabbing stuff from other places. He had a company called Translux. They're the ones that brought Speed Racer over from Japan.
Mm-hmm. They did movies, too.
And he also did Ape Man.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was the first one, but I keep reading about... Joe Oriola brought this. I don't know if he was the owner of Translux, but I know he did a lot of work with it.
I think Translux was just a distribution company. They did movies. They did a few horror movies, too, that they brought over here. I guess they were just a distributor, maybe.
Mm.
Well, the thing about Felix the Cat was that was never a network show. That was syndicated, I'm
pretty
sure.
Yeah, it was always syndicated. It was, Al and I talked in the past, you know, we horror hosts. Well, if you're our age, somewhere you lived, they had a kid's cartoon block, and they always had a guy dressed up like a cowboy, a clown,
that's right,
an astronaut.
Yeah.
When I was little in Wichita Falls, Texas, there was I guess he was supposed to be an old prospector called Pinto Bean, and he was kind of Yosemite Sam sounding, you know.
Yeah.
But I loved, they always showed the Bugs Bunny cartoons and everything else, and then we moved to Utah, and there was Captain Casey, and he was basically a guy with a, you know, like a, he had the captain's hat, an ascot, you know, the boat jacket with the crest, and it was Captain Casey. And I guess also in Utah they had a boy and girl called Fred and Faye. And we moved to Oklahoma, there was a guy called Ho Ho. He was a clown. He was greatness. Oh, also in Colorado, Denver, Colorado, there was Blinky, another clown, which used to show Pris Planet, so he was okay with me. But anyway, Ho-Ho showed all the Felix the Cat cartoons in black and white, even though the show was in color. But yeah, they were always syndicated. They were usually on some type of show like that you saw.
Yeah, because we had them in Miami. We had Charlie Baxter, who was a horror host, but he was also like a kids show host. They had a guy called Toby the Robot, a little robot, and they would show like, actually for a while there, they were showing the Marvel cartoons, and he was dressed up like, not as a superhero, but he had some kind of a getup, like a, I don't remember exactly what it was, and he would show the Marvel cartoons like at 4 in the afternoon, and like in probably like 66 or 67 or whatever, but I think after that, like it kind of ended maybe like in the late 60s, maybe that kind of stopped, and it became more, I don't know, they were just showing different syndicated programs in the afternoon.
Yeah, Ho-Ho lasted all the way up to the 80s, but, you know, they kept moving the show around.
Was he like an early morning guy, like a kid's thing in the morning?
When we moved to Oklahoma, I think he was on at lunchtime.
Oh, okay.
And then I think it was about 9, he started open. It was the morning show before he went to school.
Yeah, that's it.
And he stayed that way. But then I think by the time I was in college, he was on on Saturday mornings or Saturday afternoons. So, they moved him around at different times. He was really wonderful. I always liked him.
Yeah, because there was a guy down in the south in Miami called Skipper Chuck, and he had the morning show called Popeye Playhouse, it was called. And it started at 6 in the morning, and they had kids jumping around and yelling and screaming. They would show cartoons. And as a kid, it was kind of a weird situation because you'd watch it, but it was kind of like a bummer because you needed to have to go to school, you know? So it was kind of like, unless you were homesick and you could watch it and enjoy it, you really knew that towards the end of Skipper Chuck, you had to go to school. So it was like, oh, God. But I always wondered, how do these kids get up in the morning so early and jump up and down? Well, obviously, it was filmed the day before, you know, because some of my friends that I didn't know up until recently were actually on the show. I never got on the show or anything like that. They were actually on because this thing went from like the 60s to like probably 80 or 81. But yeah, it was on like early in the morning. They had the characters, and I guess it was right before Captain Kangaroo. Because you remember Captain Kangaroo?
Oh yeah.
That had to have been like after 8 o'clock in the morning or something. But that was, I think, for real little kids before they went to school.
Yeah, but you know, we used to see that before we went to school too. And the only problem was that any of these shows in the morning, but you only saw part of it, and you'd have to leave.
Exactly. Yeah, it was kind of a bummer.
So, except my little brother could stay home and watch all of it, and I rode my bike in the snow.
yeah, because Captain Kangaroo, I thought he came on at 8, and they had Mr. Green Jeans and all that stuff. But that was it for me. After that, I never really saw Mr. Rogers or Sesame Street or any of that stuff. I guess it kind of went to some other things or whatever.
I saw those. The stuff came out, I think I was in second or third grade, when Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street and all that came out. And again, I had a younger brother, so, you know, he would watch them.
Because he wasn't going to school yet, so he'd be like, yeah.
But the odd thing about Mr. Rogers was my brother was watching it at one point. Well, when I was little, I'd seen it. His son was my age, you know, and it was actually his two sons. One was my age and one was a couple years younger.
Oh.
And then at one point, I'm in middle school, and I come home, and my brother's watching it, and he said, his son was on. That was when yo-yos were big in 74.
Yeah.
And Mr. Rogers is going through the neighborhood, and he saw his son and one of his friends playing with yo-yos. And then that was the last time I'd ever seen it. Well, my daughter was small. They would show it in the mornings. I'd watch it. I work nights. So I'd take care of my daughter during the day. So we'd watch Barney. You know, we'd watch Sesame Street.
Oh, God,
we'd watch
all.
Well, basically, I would sleep through Barney because I was working nights, and I'd have to get up with her, and I'd kind of doze off on the couch. Kind of funny because I'd be driving to work and I just have this tune in my head and I can remember words. The other day I saw a bear, a great big bear, way up there. How do I know this song? And I mean, I could, you know, as the way went, the other day I saw a bear, a great big bear. And then one day I had the day off and, you know, I had plenty of rest, got up and watched it, and it was a Barney song. Oh, I guess wow. I just started subliminally picking it up in my head.
Oh, gosh, subliminal Barney, man. You got to be careful for that. I didn't know Barney had messages. He probably had messages like eat more soda or eat more candy or something. Like probably the opposite. But probably the cartoons that we saw in the 60s probably had subliminals that eat more candy.
Yeah, that was
drink
we
more
kids.
Soda or whatever.
But anyway, I was watching Mr. Rogers, and I was thinking about that. I said, yeah, I remember his son. I wonder how he's doing. And his son came over the house with his kid, which was my daughter's age.
Oh,
and
man.
I thought, well, isn't that something? And on Sesame Street, a lot of the people that were on the show when I was little was on the show when my daughter was small. Gordon, oh. Susan, and a guy named Bob. So, long careers.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was the guys who did a lot of the TV shows back when we were kids. They were the weathermen. So as long as they were on doing the weather, they would be, you'd still see them on TV. I think the guy, the horror host from here, what's his face?
Paul
Bear was a weatherman.
I never see.
He just wore glasses. I guess he keep a secret identity or whatever. He was the weatherman here. And then he, you know, like on Saturday afternoons, he'd like, hey, I'm the horror guy or whatever. Same thing with Charlie Baxter, the guy over in Miami. He was the weatherman, and then he became M.T. Graves. He got more popular as M.T. Graves, the horror host, and then it was like, hey, you know, well, enough with the weather. And then, like, you know, years later, they just got Hot Chick to do the weather, you know.
Yeah, well.
Which is a good thing.
That's. Yeah, but no, anyway, going back to the, Harvey.
Harvey cartoons, yes.
Well, Joe Oriolo created Casper the Friendly Ghost, and the reason he created it was his daughter was afraid of the dark. And so he created Casper because he was a friendly ghost, and she didn't have to be afraid. So basically, that's what they built that whole cartoon on, and that's where it came from.
Okay.
Hot Stuff was never one of the cartoons. I remember they had a Baby Huey was one.
Yeah.
A character called Little Audrey, which I remember seeing in advertisements for the comic books.
And Little Dot or something, the girl with the dots.
Yeah, Dot was never on the cartoon. She was in the comic books, and Little Lotta. But I'm trying to think. Little Audrey never really made sense to me. And I found out the history to that was, you know, the John Stanley comics, Little Lulu.
Yeah, it was a ripoff.
Well, yeah, what happened was there was a woman named Marge. I can't remember her last name. She was.
Oh, yeah, because they used to say Marge is Little Lulu or something.
Well, she was a panel artist, you know, I think Saturday Evening, I don't know what it was, New Yorker, Saturday Evening Post, it was one of those magazines. You know how Playboy always had the big painted cartoons in their magazine?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, her Little Lulu was hers. It was a panel cartoon.
Oh.
And I don't know if it was actually called Little Lulu, but it was that character. And
it was Little Lulu wasn't in Playboy, though.
No, it was in, like, I don't know, Saturday
Esquire
Evening Post.
Esquire or one of those, or, yeah.
Well, it was in one of the family magazines. Yeah, mainstream.
Yeah.
But anyway, she was in it, and the character got so popular that it was licensed out somehow. John Stanley started doing it. That's why it said Marge is Little Lulu. Well, Famous Studios started making a Little Lulu cartoon. And, you know, they paid all this money for, you know, for the character. And I guess at one point they just decided to, you know, why are we paying this? Let's come up with our own. And they created Little Audrey.
Okay.
So basically Little Audrey was a Little Lulu knockoff.
Mm.
And she wasn't all that funny. Sometimes if somebody would find a pile of comics and give them to you, there'd be an issue of Little Audrey. I read a couple as I was a kid. I mean, they were fine. You know, they were drawn by the regular Harvey artist.
Right.
But, you know, and then she kind of faded away. But anyway, Harvey Comics started licensing the characters and making their own comics. You know, Casper, Wendy. They had a Little Audrey comic, Baby Huey, all this stuff. And then I guess after a while they stopped making the cartoons. He bought the characters out outright.
He did?
Yeah, so Harvey Comics owned the characters.
Okay.
But I guess it'd be like if, I can't think of any other time that ever happened, but it'd be like if, say, the Flashers created Superman and did the cartoon, and then, you know, National Periodical said, hey, we'll make a comic book, and then after the cartoons went away, they bought the character, but anyway, from there, that's when they started creating Hot Stuff, which is basically Casper with a diaper and horns and a tail. And they created Richie Rich, who's Casper, you know, as a kid. And a rich kid. But you know, they used a template, but I was really surprised to find out it was actually the cartoon, you know, Famous Studios first, and it went on. But they were great cartoons, I mean, comic books, and then I guess it was in the mid-70s, they really started doing a backslide. Ernie Colon was one of their...
Was he doing them in the 60s or no?
I don't know. I just heard he did it, and I could tell some of the ways he did it. It was still a Richie Rich comic, but there was some of the Ernie Colon cross-hatching and stuff in some of the backgrounds and stuff. And there was Warren Krimmer, who was a Golden Age artist. He used to do a comic called Black Cat, you know.
Yeah. I think Eli Elias did some of those, too.
Yeah,
that was that female character, right? The Black Cat?
Yeah, I never heard of her until I saw Digital Comics Museum.
Yeah, yeah.
But she looks like a mockingbird from
exactly.
Marvel Comics.
Exactly, yeah. She rode a motorcycle or something.
Well, she had a motorcycle, but then there's other covers that says Black Cat Western, so she's on a horse.
Yeah.
Cowboys, and I thought, okay.
However she get her, you know, wherever she...
I don't know.
Whatever transportation.
The Western comic, I thought was kind of odd, but...
Yeah, I'm sure. Lee Elias was art, and Warren Kremer was too. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really. The Harvey cartoonist never signed the names to anything. So.
Well, you know, going on DCM, the Harvey stuff from the 50s, they did War. They did all the genres. They did War. They did horror. They did romance books, and they had some great artists. Man, I've been finding stuff like a lot of Bob Powell, a lot of Howard Nostrand. What's his face? Kirby and Al Williamson did Rocket to the Moon.
Yeah,
for them. Tuska did work for them. Jack Sparling. They were a pretty good comic book company. But by the time you're talking about, I think they just went totally into funny characters or whatever.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that they did anything else. I was always surprised to find out they did Will Eisner's The Spirit.
Yeah, they did The Spirit.
You and I have talked about their old superhero titles they had done, but Yeah, they. It was a bizarre company. I've seen some other comics they've done that I thought was kind of strange.
The Man in Black, that was Bob Powell. That was like a horror thing. But those things, I guess, when they started like getting rid of all the horror books, I guess they kind of like shifted maybe into funny stuff. I know they were doing Westerns and War. That was still like okay, I guess, but. Yeah, I think by the time we'll have to look into that. By the time Oriolo got involved or whatever happened, they just went totally funny stuff. I never read Casper, Richie Rich, Little. I never read one of them.
See, I just can't relate to it. I got a stack of them. They were just great fun. And again, when I was a little kid, your parents, grandparents would always buy you one.
Yeah.
And they were fun. They were always in the forest. They were always somewhere. In Hot Stuff Comics, there was a backup strip called Stumbo, which was a giant, a good-hearted giant. And I loved how they used to draw, like, this little village out in the mountains. And it was kind of like a Eastern European German, you know. It was just well done, well drawn. I mean, the stories were always the same thing, you know. Casper was basically his little ghost walker. Would you be my friend? I didn't mean to scare him. Please be my friend. Oh, my. What did I do?
And he never had an origin. He never gave an origin for Casper.
No, you didn't need one. Okay. It was just a ghost.
It was just a ghost.
You know, and the ghostly trio? You know, his three older brothers?
I don't remember that at all. The ghostly trio? I don't remember that.
Well, they were the three tall, skinny ghosts with those ice cream top heads.
Oh, God. Yeah, okay.
And, which the Ghostbusters mascot looked like. And I'm told that Harvey's sons tried to sue him for that.
Oh, God, that's
but,
funny.
And then Wendy, the good little witch, she had her three aunts, which were the tall, thin, green-faced witches with purple robes. And they felt Wendy was ugly. And Hot Stuff was always on his own.
Yeah, well, his dad is busy doing other stuff.
Well, they never said that there was other devils, you know, they all lived underground and always come up, but they weren't like demons from hell, they were just creatures that lived underneath the ground, you know, and they could fly, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, that Hot Stuff was the inspiration for Rosemary's Baby, I think. Anyway, I'm just joking.
Just kidding. A lot of guys I was in the Navy with have Hot Stuff tattooed to their arm.
Yeah, that was popular for a while. Yeah. I guess they thought they were Hot Stuff or whatever.
Well, just, you know, everybody remembered it fondly.
I mean, by the time I started reading comics, you know, everything, it just, you know, seemed juvenile to me, you know, whatever. Well, you know?
It was.
But Archie was different because Archie almost seemed like it was something you wanted to aspire to be a teenager, yeah. You know, and get like, you know, and get chicks and have cars and, you know, all that stuff.
Well, the Richie Rich comics, they were fun on different levels because, one, it was just neat seeing all the stuff, you know, like they'd have him in a, it was always jokes, but like there was one where he's in a room with all these different television monitors, he could watch all the different shows.
I remember, you know, that.
There was another where he's in the bathtub, and I put these on the blog whenever I talk about Richie Rich, but he's in the bathtub and they have all these mechanical arms washing him, you know. They're always funny, you know. But the insides, sometimes it was just kind of bizarre stuff, like he had so much money he didn't know what to do with and was trying to move it around. Other times it was some kind of gadget he had. His butler, Cadbury, could do anything. He was a fantastic character.
I remember Cadbury.
Well, I thought you never read these.
I remember that name because I remember seeing panels of it. And I remember there was some butler-looking dude. Because his name was Cadbury, reminded me of the chocolate. Cadbury.
Yeah.
But that's an English name, so, you know.
But, you know, they were always kind of funny. One time he was, one story started with his father running with a stamp, you know, the postage stamps, because everybody collected stamps. And he said, Richie, I just got you the rare so-and-so stamp that, you know, to put in your collection. And it showed Richie just kind of bored with it. And he goes, well, what's wrong? And then he showed him, he just had vaults and vaults of stamp books. He had every stamp ever made in any country, you know, and he said it just wasn't fun anymore. You know, that's what Rook says, a lot of the fun of finding the comics is digging for them, the hunt.
Yeah,
you know?
That's it, yeah.
And, you know, if you were the richest kid in the world, and, you know, his dad was very supportive about it, so, you know, his dad felt bad, and Rich said, oh, that's okay. So he went over to his friend's Freckles house, who was, you know, just a regular kid. Of course, when they showed Freckles, they lived in kind of a dilapidated house, and him and his little brother had patches on their jeans. But
Richie wouldn't help them out financially or anything?
Well, they never asked for money. He never offered. Well, they weren't dirt poor. His father had a job at a plant. They were just, I guess,
regular people, yeah.
Yeah, since Richie was rich, they were trying to show they weren't, but they were happy, you know.
Yeah.
But
I would have hit him up for a few.
Yeah. But anyway, he went over to Freckles' house and, hey, Richie, you're just in time to see my stamp collection. Oh, I just. And it wasn't a postage stamp collection. He had rubber stamps, and, you know, with ink.
Oh, okay.
And he'd get the stamps, and he had a book, and he'd stamp them and show them. And he had six stamps he was kind of excited about. And Richie's like, hey, that's different. So next thing you know, Richie Rich had 60 billion stamps in his house, you know, the rubber stamps. That was a Richie Rich story.
So basically, it's basically telling you that even though you may think that money can't buy you happiness.
It can.
It can.
Well, my cousin, you know, all my cousins, my brother, everybody had Richie Rich comics.
Oh, God.
My cousin was asking one time, and he was still in elementary school. But he's asking his mom, he says, why is it everybody in the city calls him Monster Richie? I mean, the police, everybody, the teachers, everybody says, oh, Master Richie, how are you doing? I always thought that was kind of odd. A little kid in a little velvet short sleeve, you know, shorts suit, you know, calling Master, because it means young man. Well, they don't call anybody else that.
But Jackie Chan was young master.
Yeah, he's the man.
Yeah.
But the other thing I'd understand was, if Richie Rich was in elementary school, how could he drive a car around town?
I thought he had a chauffeur.
He did have a chauffeur, but he drove cars all the time.
I guess when you're that rich, you can just buy yourself.
Well, that
a
was absolutely
license.
What it was. In one of the stories, there was an identity thief. He was a little guy, and he dressed up like, you know, Richie Rich and was driving one of his sports cars through town. And the police pulled him over and says, I'm sorry to pull you over, Master Richie. He says, but you're driving kind of fast. Yeah, what is it, officer? He's acting that way. And the police was kind of taken aback. He goes, well, technically, you're not even supposed to be driving. Well, yeah, what is that? He is a little kid. Why is he getting to drive? So you're right. Money can buy everything, but
I'm telling you,
I guess,
especially,
you know,
in the '60s.
But it was still fun to read as a kid, and sometimes they were great adventure stories. They had all these That's when I learned Google. You know, this is long before the internet. There was a character called Google.
On Richie Rich.
Yeah, on Richie Rich. It was in 1976. But he says, I am the Google. And there was a guy in a regular business suit with a red sock covering, you know, all the way down to his neck. And
yeah.
I think he had a G on the forehead of it. It was a red kind of sock cloth mask with eyes cut out. And he was the Google.
Huh.
And they were trying to figure out what the Google was. And Richie Rich says, his teacher taught, it's a one followed by a thousand zeros.
Okay.
That's Google.
Okay.
Well, the beginning of the story, they're trying to find out who the Google is, and he's causing all this trouble. And they're shutting down all of Mr. Rich's oil plants and, you know, shipments and everything else. And Richie Rich figures out it's that fighter pilot from World War II that befriended Richie's dad.
Mm.
Because his story was, he was a single fighter plane that was followed by 1,000 Japanese planes, and he survived and escaped.
Wow.
What are Japanese planes called?
Zeros.
1,000 zeros. He's the Google. And to this day, whenever I use Google, which is a really nice internet search engine, I think of that Richie Rich story.
Wow. You are the Richie Rich expert. See, was Richie Rich a cartoon?
No, never. Harvey Comics created it, and like I said, they used Casper as a template.
Oh, okay.
But it was a cartoon, and
it might have been later on in the 80s.
Yeah,
or
Ruby Spears did a Richie Rich cartoon. I didn't hardly ever watch it because I was working. But it might have been in like 1981 or 82. Ruby Spears did it, but he wasn't in the You know, he had that old-fashioned black velvet suit with a red bow tie and short pants.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the Ruby Spears cartoon, I think he had a red sweater with a dollar sign on it and long pants, which, you know, was fine. But, yeah, he had a robot maid named Irona. There was a nurse called Jenny. My wife used to read the comics in the Philippines because the base was close by, and sometimes the comic books would end up out in town. And when there was a movie with Macaulay Culkin,
was a Richie Rich movie, I was going to say.
Yeah, and we went to see it at the drive-in when my daughter was small.
Oh, the drive-in.
Yeah, all those were great. But we went to see that, and when the movie was, and the movie was so-so, we had fun. I think Florence Henderson played his mom.
Yes, correct. And, I never saw it, but I remember now, yeah.
But I remember we left, and Myrna was asking, says, Richie, in the comic books, Richie Rich's parents were fat. Yeah, they were. They were, you know, really big people. And, you know, it was fun. I still like to look at them. I mean, a lot of the cartoonists they had were brilliant cartoonists, and the stories are fun, you know. And
Now, didn't Warren Kremer create Hot Stuff?
Or
was it Oriola?
I didn't. The way I found out who Warren Kremer was Marvel Comics in the early 80s were wanting to do a kid's line of comics. I guess they started publishing Dennis the Menace.
That's right. Now I remember that, yeah.
And then they created a Star line of comics. And what they wanted was they wanted to buy the Harvey comics and publish them. And what I'm told, and I don't know this for sure, but the Harvey brothers, the guy's kids, were always fighting, and they were wanting too much money. So instead, Marvel Comics created the Star line. And they had Royal Roy. He was a prince of a boy.
Okay.
There was there was another one, a kid in space. Astro Terry? Or Planet Terry. There was a character called Top Dog, which I don't know, that wasn't a ripoff of anything. But Wally the Wizard. But they all looked like Warren Kremer drew them.
Well, it says here that Warren Kremer was the creator of Richie Rich, Hot Stuff, and Stumbo the Giant.
Ah, okay, well, I really love Warren Kremer, how he drew. And even on the Marvel Comics Star line, they were great. And I have to admit, I was in the Navy at the time, close to getting out. And Marvel published the Ewoks, you know, that George Lucas, you know, Star Wars characters. They had a Star Comics line.
Yep, there it is right there.
And Warren Kremer drew it.
Ewoks, Planet Terry, Royal Roy, and Top Dog.
Yeah, okay. But the Ewoks, I saw an issue at a comic store, picked it up, and I mean, it looked like, even though it was Star Wars characters and he drew them like that, they looked like the old Hot Stuff type things. I really enjoyed it. So I went to every 7-Eleven in town and found all the back issues. I've got every one of them. And they also did the Ewoks, the droids cartoon.
No, yeah, I remember that too.
I think
yeah.
John Romita drew that one.
Oh, okay. It says here Colon, Ernie Colon, going back to him, began his career at Harvey Comics as a letterer. He later worked in credit as an artist on titles Richie Rich and Casper. This must have been in the 60s, because he ended up working, he was working for Marvel in the late 60s.
Well, I didn't know that. I started seeing Ernie Colon's work, I think in the first issue of Epic Illustrated. And I used to see him in some Marvel comics, maybe in the late 70s, like backup stories.
Right.
And I always recognized that I've seen this guy before. I couldn't figure out where it was. Come to find out, it was the old Richie Rich comics.
And yeah. Amethyst.
Yeah, well, see, that was much later.
That was much later, yeah. But I think that's getting rebooted from DC. Obviously, yeah, they're going to reboot everything.
Well, they reboot everything.
Yeah.
So. But no, there's some guy bought Richie Rich, I guess, in the 90s. Late 80s or early 90s, and they were trying to publish them again. They had Felix the Cat as one of the, it was still called Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
But I bought a couple of those, but, you know, a lot of times they'd reprint them. But they're wonderful.
They do digests of them, too? Like, I remember seeing those at the supermarket.
Yeah, my daughter had a couple of those.
Yeah, I remember those, yeah.
But the earlier Richie Rich stuff was just, it was terrific comics. And, they were always fun. A lot of times at Richie Rich, they put a little Lotta story and a little Dot story in it. Little Dot was just a girl that liked dots, and the whole story was her collecting dots. But but sometimes those stories were really fun.
They're almost like surreal in a way.
Well, they were surreal, and she had uncles and aunts. And one time she had to meet her parents had to go somewhere, so her uncle Weirdo came over and watched her. And it looked like kind of a college beatnik, you know. I guess it was an old 60s story. Well, what are you doing, Uncle Weirdo? I'm going to contact the fifth dimension. And he starts getting all these markers out and starts marking up all these geometric Picasso-looking designs on the wall. And all these monsters from the fifth dimension came out, and I think they ended up going in. It looked like something Steve Ditko would have came up with.
Wow.
I love that. I mean, there was always these weird, you know. Little Dot always had uncles and aunts, and of course Uncle Weirdo to me was the greatest one, but you know, she had one was like an aunt shop, you know, she liked to shop, you know, and just weird stuff.
When will the archives arrive?
Well, that's what I was wondering about. I'm surprised that nobody's put out it don't have to be an expensive one, but just collections of these comics, you know.
They have early Archie ones, I've seen those on.
Yeah, they have the Archie, but you know, like IDW should put out some Richie Rich, but
God, okay. Ernesto Sierra de Cordobés y López Colón. Ernie Colón, that's his whole name.
He's Spanish?
And Puerto Rican. 81 years old and still alive. Good for him. God bless him.
I never knew that. Yeah.
But what a name. Ernesto Sierra de Cordobés y López Colón.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go.
I keep forgetting you speak Spanish. That's right.
Sí. Hey, let's go. Let's do some music.
All right, well, it's been a while since we played him, but since I found out Ernie Colon is Spanish, let's play our friend Pierre Legault.
Sad fall. ocean of golden showers, province of noble cowards, quick to blame, be right or wrong. So strengthen your common fibers, bury your hatchet, fathers. The world's races make us strong. With the pride of my country, I will build and my brothers will help me. Separation will falter so quickly to a sad song. And with the Lord, victory. With the gilded stallions chasing him, war had ended the first summertime we met. Our hearts grew fonder for the homeland yet. With the pride of my country, I will build and my brothers will help me. Separation will falter so quickly to a sad song.
I don't know why I thought a Spanish-speaking cartoonist would relate to a French-singing, or an English-singing French composer, but nevertheless, that was our friend Pierre Legault.
Pierre Legault, he's been on many times, and I'm sure he'll be on again.
There you go.
So what's up, man? What's next? What's next on the agenda? Now that we've told you the Harvey comic, well, some of the Harvey
story. Yeah, exhausted my limited knowledge of
that
Harvey
was pretty
comics.
Good, though. I mean, you know, you know more than I did, you know. And we'll have a lot of fun looking for Harvey JPEGs all throughout the net or whatever to put on.
Oh, they were fun comics. There's actually a lot of comics that I've been picking up that I've enjoyed like that. IDW's Popeye. You know, there's
that's nice.
They got the new ones, which Roger Langridge writes. And actually, my favorite issue, I think, was the fifth one. He drew it as well.
I was talking about the reprint. I don't know the.
The new books.
I didn't get the new ones.
Well, the new ones, Roger Langridge writes, and they have three or four different cartoonists that draw them, and they're very good. I like them. But once I think Bruce Oziola or something like that. He did the first issue, and then there's different guys come in. They all draw closely to what Seeger, the original cartoonist, worked. It has a certain look to it, but I think it was the fifth one. Roger Langridge drew it as well, and it was my favorite one. He just, everything hit, the story was great, the artwork just went right along with it.
Mm, cool.
I guess he's really good, but he can't do an issue every month. But
yeah, what was the artist that I was reading about? We were talking about him, that was a really good artist, but he got off the book because he couldn't do it every month. It's not Dave Stevens, but it was somebody else. I can't. It'll hit me in the middle of the show.
Well, Dave Cockrum was one of those.
That's it. Dave Cockrum was the guy. Yeah, you told me he had to quit X-Men because he couldn't do a monthly. Even though they were bi-monthly, he was having trouble hitting the bi-monthly mark or whatever.
Well, I think he could do the bi-monthly. Well, I was kind of... It's funny. There's a Facebook group about Dave Cockrum, which is really nice. And my favorite work he ever did, as I've said before, is the Legion of Superheroes. And it was basically a reboot. You know, I'd always read the Legion of Superheroes in these old reprints from the 50s, which I really liked. And I guess they had some from the 60s. And Kurt Swan drew them, you know, different artists. And I guess they had some newer stories, but they were kind of knocked out quickly. You know, like Second Thoughts, they were always backup stories. And then in 1971 or 72... Murphy Anderson and Dave Cockrum, which I guess was Murphy Anderson's assistant, did new Legionnaire stories. And some of them, they were changing their costumes, you know, just slowly. But, you know, instead of the clubhouse being an inverted rocket ship, it was a really slick white building with a big L on the front, you know.
I remember.
And some of the bad guys were coming back in different, you know, outfits. And kind of like what they did to the new X-Men.
Didn't Teen Titans do something like that, too? Or
yeah,
no?
Teen Titans did it later, but...
They had that weird building, yeah,
but there was
no
announcement. It just happened. It was a backup story in Superboy. And I guess after a few times with Murphy Anderson Inc. and Dave Cockrum, you know, he was doing 10-page stories, and he drew it and inked it. Cary Bates was writing the stories. And... it was just the most thrilling thing as an 11-year-old kid to see these characters I really loved and bringing them into the, you know, modern age. And to me, that was Dave Cockrum's slickest, best work I'd ever seen. His storytelling, his panel design, everything was just, it was like watching a movie every time. And I'm guessing he did 10, 11 issues and then disappeared. But Bob Brown and Murphy Anderson was doing the Superboy lead story. And the Legion of Superheroes is the backup. And after a couple of issues, it swapped. And the Legion of Superheroes had the front story. And the Bob Brown, Murphy Anderson story was the back.
Right,
I think Murphy Anderson retired and other people started inking Bob Brown. But
see, I never got those books. I'd like to find them because I don't know if they're reprinted or not. They will be eventually, but
well,
I don't know if they've...
I think they've kind of reprinted here and there, but it never like a Dave Cockrum special.
See, the Legions that I remember, the ones that I didn't like, were Mike Grell. I didn't particularly care for those. And I remember a lot of those. This was like 74, maybe?
Well, Dave Cockrum walked out in 74. What they say the whole dispute was they had one full issue where that character Bouncing Boy and the character Dual Damsel got married. They went to Mars and got married. And in the middle of the story... Well, the whole wedding scene, it's a two-page spread, and it's them in the middle with a priest and then the legions around them. It had all these other characters, Tars Tarkas from the John Carter of Warlord of Mars, he's in the audience, you know. And, I mean, different characters. It was fun, but it was a really neat strip. And the way he drew Mars, I guess they had some type of molten lava canal going through and all this neat stuff. And the story was that Dave Cockrum asked for that artwork to be given back to him. And I guess whoever the editor was said, yeah, sure. You know, you're going to give him the two pages. And then Carmine Infantino said no. When he found out about it, you know, he said, no, there's no way you're getting this back. Dave Cockrum got fed up and left. And he had plans for the Legion because Storm from the X-Men was supposed to be in the Legion of Superheroes. Nightcrawler and Colossus were all designed to go in the Legion of Superheroes. I don't think Storm was actually going to be in the Legion. I think she was going to be like some offshoot, you know.
Oh, the character designs. I got you, yeah.
But, anyway, I know he had a story I keep hearing about that he wanted the Blackhawks to meet the Legion, and somebody, maybe Barry Motinoff, said no. But, anyway, it was over that, I'm told, that two-page spread. He wanted the artwork returned, and they wouldn't, and so he walked out and went to Marvel.
Wow.
So there was one story of Colossal Boy and Shrinking Violet that Cockrum had inked, but he hadn't pencil, but hadn't inked. And Mike Grell walked in the office, and I said, well, we got this, ink it, and we'll see. Okay, this is good, you're hired. And Mike Grell became the artist for the Legion of Superheroes.
Oh, okay, all right. Because him I remember a lot doing, at least he did a couple of years at least.
Yeah, he did it for a few years. I didn't like him as well as Dave Cockrum, but I liked it when I was a kid. As I look back on it, I don't, but when I was a kid, I did enjoy him. But anyway, Dave Cockrum went over to Marvel and did the Legion of Superheroes on Monthly. I guess he's also an art director, and he did a lot of covers, which were beautiful covers, but I get aggravated because there was like a Ms. It was a cover with Ms. Marvel with this really cool bird attacking her. A giant bird.
Yeah.
And I want to get it so bad, and the interior art didn't go anywhere close to it.
Well, he drew Ms. Marvel, didn't he? At least one or two.
He did a couple when they rebooted her, and
yeah,
she changed
her. Yeah,
because
they were nice. I remember that.
Yeah, he drew the first two, and I think Bob Wiechek inked it.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
I really like it better when Dave Cockrum inked his own work, but anyway, he did the X-Men, and I guess they were planning on making the X-Men monthly, and he couldn't do it. And I guess he didn't want to leave the book. He hated to. But that's when he left and John Byrne took over. And Dave Cockrum always stayed involved. He always did covers, you know, anything like that he could. And then when John Byrne left the book, Dave Cockrum stepped in. But I didn't buy them. I'd look at a couple of copies friends of mine would have, and it wasn't his best work. But
I kind of liked them because I liked the inking by Joe Rubenstein. I thought it was okay. And then Paul Smith took over after that, I guess.
Yeah, well, Dave left again because it was, you know, too much. But sometime in the 90s, I was kind of excited. I picked up a Legion comic from DC. And I guess, as well as comics where they had different people do a few pages here and there. And I was excited that, you know, Dave Cockrum was credited as doing a couple of new pages. And then I looked at them, and they didn't look anything like Dave Cockrum. I never would have
really?
Thought. So. Hmm. I don't know. But yeah, he was fantastic, and those designs, they still use a lot of the designs he came up with in that comic now.
You know what Dave Cockrum did too that you probably don't know this? You may, but you might not. He drew the designs for some of the Aurora models in the 70s, like Rodan and I think they were called the Monsters of the Movies.
I didn't know that.
They based Rodan and I think Ghidra on his interpretation of it. Yeah, that's why they look a little different than the movie thing was, because he was the guy who basically kind of like, designed it.
He always had fun stuff, and like in the Legion of Superheroes, he started, their spaceships look kind of like Star Trek. You know, he was...
Yeah.
Well, he was a fan like we were.
He drew Star Trek, too.
Yeah, I think he did Star Trek.
He did the first few issues, maybe. Yeah, he did Star Trek,
He did a lot of really beautiful covers.
He was a big fan. He was a fan of comics. Yeah,
but you used
time.
To see, like, I guess it was in X-Men, there was another planet, and they had one of the Shogun Warriors, those Japanese superheroes that Mattel put out as the Shogun Warriors.
Marvel did those, too.
Yeah, but before they did those comics in the Uncanny X-Men, he had one of those Shogun Warriors, like in a city scene, like he was a guard or something. I just always put these little odd things in the background that I always loved about him.
Now we're going to go off on a tangent just for a second. When you mentioned Shogun Warriors and we were talking about the Japanese monsters, Herb Trimpe did some of those comics.
Yeah.
I still, you know, I can go back now and like a lot of artists. But Trimpe, I haven't warmed up to him. I don't know why. Can you tell me? Can you help me out?
You and I talked about this, and you know, we talked about on the show that there was cartoonists we didn't like as kids that we really grew to appreciate now. And one time, not on the show, I told you, well, there's one artist that I haven't, and I hate to say it, but it's Herb Trimpe. And
he's a good artist.
Yeah.
Something about his style.
I guess he did the work, but it just seemed to me like it was just kind of knocked out, like it was surface. He didn't really put anything in it. It was just, you know, by the numbers. That's just how I always took it. It was limited. But I hear people talk about him all the time like it was greatness. And maybe they were really young. But,
yeah, it must have been impressionable. Yeah.
But they have a great, you know, love. I know he did the G.I. Joe comic for a long time.
That's right, yeah. The one that came out in the 80s, yeah.
Yeah, because a guy on my ship would read comics, but he didn't save them. He said, "Here, you want these?" And, you know, he liked the G.I. Joe comic, and I'd look, and I just put it away because, I don't know. I don't want to say anything bad about somebody.
Yeah, like yeah, yeah. Said, it's just, it hasn't clicked.
He has a following, but it just seemed to me like, I don't know. No, I've never gotten
it. And it was really weird because when I first moved here, I went to one of those Tampa cons or whatever, and I was talking to a friend of mine from North Carolina, and I told him Trimpy's going to be there. He goes, "Oh, can you give me a sketch?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." So, you know, I go there, and he's sitting there, and I go, "Yeah, excuse me, you know, Mr. Trimpy, can I get a sketch?" And it was like, this is 2006. It was $50 for a headshot. And I was like, okay. So I walk up to him. He goes, "Yeah, okay, could you hold on for a second?" And he just took off for like a half an hour, and I'm just standing there, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And I'm just standing there, and finally he comes back, and like he does this sketch. It was a nice sketch in like, you know, 10 minutes or whatever. But I was like, wow, really? $50? Okay, I guess that's the going rate now, and you're kind of like an old school Marvel artist, but I didn't really appreciate being made to stand there for 15 minutes while he had to go to the bathroom or whatever the heck he was doing or whatever. But a friend of mine in South Florida had dealings with him, and he basically forgot what it was. He sent him some movies, or I don't know how I got a hold of him, but anyway, Trimpy did some art free for him, but he got something in return. He got some movies, or he got some books or something. So I guess it was like an even swap or whatever. So I'm sure he's a very nice guy.
Yeah, I'm.
But that was just a weird story that I heard. Well, Trimpy story.
You gotta go to the bathroom. You gotta go to the bathroom.
I don't know if he did or not. He just took off, and I was just like, "Oh, okay." And it was just weird.
Yeah, but he came back. I mean,
yeah, he did. He came back, you know. But I was getting ready to leave, so it would have been like, "Okay, well, you know." I don't know.
No, he did Incredible Hulk for a long time. I used to pick him up once in a while because, you know. That Wolverine, the first time Wolverine appeared, Herb Trimpe drew that. Not the cover, but
yeah,
he did the interior.
Yeah, the inside, yeah. Al Milgram did the cover or somebody like that.
Was it? I think he inked it. I don't think he drew it.
Maybe he inked it. I was like, was it Hulk 180 something?
I couldn't tell you the number.
181.
It's a nice
something.
Looking cover, though.
Yeah, because that when I was running a comic shop, everybody, that was one of the key issues. Yeah. Punisher. The Spider-Man, they had the first appearance of Punisher and the first Wolverine. And
I had both of those. I had both of those.
Bottom off the stands.
Yeah, when I was a kid.
Yeah, you know, that's good, I guess. You know, whatever. You can't keep... You think you got rid of them somewhere along the way? Or they got lost somewhere along the way?
When I was newly married, my wife and I were moving around so much, and I just was trying to get rid of certain things. So I sold a whole bunch of comic books at the store I always went to since I was a kid. And, I mean, just a big bundle of stuff. And he said, "Okay, I can work with it." So he gave me $100 for it.
That's
in store credit. And the economy in Oklahoma at the time was really bad. And he said, "Well, I saw some things in there I thought I could work with, but it hasn't worked." Well, one of the things he looked at was that issue of the Hulk. And it was years later, I saw it in the 90s, and somebody wanted $300 for it. What? I wouldn't have gave a quarter for it, you know, but, you know.
Neither here nor there.
But the first Punisher in Spider-Man I always kept because I liked it. It was Ross Andrew, who
I
love
yeah,
dearly.
Yeah.
I love that cover. I love that first page when you open it up. And I just, even though it wasn't a prize comic of mine, I mean, I loved it. But, you know, as time went on, I thought, well, you know, I was trying to make space. So I took some comics in to sell. You know, it's a few here and there, some X-Men, Dave Cockrum stuff. And so I brought that one in. And the guy put it on. I guess he was selling it for, I got $95 out of it.
That's not bad.
And that was a comic I got for a quarter, 35 cents.
Yeah, that's not bad.
But what I really like about it was the guy came in. And he was asking about a Punisher miniseries that had come out.
The Mike Zach one, right?
Well, this was in the 90s, so I don't know who did it.
Yeah, I think it was Zach.
but he kept asking about it, and then the guy said, have you ever seen the first appearance of Punisher? No. And he had it on his wall, and he pulled it out, and the guy was all excited. And Mark, the guy that ran the store, basically, yeah, Mark loved comics.
Mark Fountain?
Know? Yeah, Mark Fountain. Yeah, he loved comics. And basically, Mark was at the counter, and he took the, you know, he basically looked at every single panel, every page, and talked about it. And the guy was all excited, so he bought it. You know, so I got my commission. And I don't know, I like the story even better. I'm glad it went to somebody who really appreciated it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
sure.
I, the Hulk, I didn't care about. I bought it, I liked it, but I didn't love it. And, but, you know, that one I always liked, and I'm glad that it went to somebody else, and I got some store credit and bought some French comics with it.
All right. But, some Mobius, probably.
No, it was J.C. Mezier's.
Oh, it had Mezier's. Oh, okay.
But, no, yeah, but Herb Trimpe was somebody, half the time I just felt like he really didn't like what he did, you know, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember towards the end of his run with Marvel, he started drawing in a Rob Liefeld style, and it was just like, oh, no.
Oh, really? He didn't? Well,
yeah, he changed his style to try to image up his art a little bit.
Well, you know, it's a thing. Didn't DC Comics tell Kurt Swan you're not marketable anymore?
Yeah, that's...
So, I can see why he would do that, because, you know, everybody was trying to draw like Rob Liefeld, so, you know.
How can you tell Kurt Swan? Well, hell, you know, like in the 50s, Frazetta was doing Lil Abner, and then he got into some kind of a squabble with Al Cap, and he wanted a raise, and Al Cap wouldn't do it, so he quit. So he actually, Frazetta went in the early 60s, looking around for work at DC, I guess, or whatever. And some jackass at DC told him, your art style is old and antiquated. So I think he ended up doing some, he got work from George Evans inking him or whatever and some other people. And then he started doing the paperback covers, and then you know, the rest is history. But yeah, some editor told him that his art style was antiquated. Yeah, go, you know, real brain,
well,
real geniuses.
You know, but I understand. I sent you a link to that Jeff Jones documentary they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
The one I sent to you, I think I sent you the wrong one, but it was Mike Mignola.
Yeah.
And that one was something, because he wasn't even talking on what I saw about Jeff Jones. He was talking about when he was drawing and how he started kind of developing the style he's got now. He was starting to go a little bit further out, and one of the editors looked at the page and said, well, you're really starting to get a little, you know, too far to weird. And but Mike Mignola was really enjoying how he's drawing. He was, you know, freeing up and having some fun and enjoying himself. And he said, well, we'll take this, but don't get any further than this, or we're not buying anymore. And, you know, Mike Mignola basically, he said, well, he's wanting to continue to draw in that way. And he did. But, you know, he went on his own. But I guess, basically, if you're working for a company and doing their work, you kind of got to do what they say. You know, Mike Mignola's case, and Frazetta's case, they went on and did stuff, and Jeff Jones. They went on and did their own thing. And then,
Jeff Jones always did his own thing.
Yeah, he did.
You know, he was always doing that.
Somebody posted on Facebook a Jeff Jones drawing of a woman holding a bow, you know, getting ready to shoot an arrow. And I'll tell you, it's a simple black and white line drawing, you know, with rough ink, you know, around the bow. But you can feel the tension on the line. You know, it's fantastic. You can see the strength in that woman's, you know, left arm. It's not a static. He was really something else, you know.
It's funny how quickly he progressed, too, because, I mean, his early stuff was really simple. I don't know if simplistic, but it's like almost like wooden, and within, like, a few years, it became this beautiful, naturalistic thing. But I remember hearing an interview with Louise Jones, and she said his art changed a lot when he started using photographic.
Yeah, reference. I remember. I learned that from
you. I mentioned that, too. So I guess, you know, the more he got into the, you know, photography and stuff like that, the art became a little more natural, a little stronger, maybe.
But I love Kurt Swan, and so I'm going to say this. I'm saying in all honesty. Whenever Cena telling me it wasn't marketable anymore, at the time I agreed with it. I didn't like seeing it. He drew Superman forever. And I remember somebody, I was in college, this is 1982, they brought in an old Superman comic from 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't tell any difference except that Murphy Anderson was inking
right.
the one from 73 compared to now. It was good, but it was the same thing. And Superman and Clark Kent just seemed grandfatherly to me.
That's because he never saw him do anything else but Superman.
Yeah, but I remember
he kind of got stuck doing that.
He did, what was it? They had a really nice series called Superman the Hidden Years. It was basically, it was four issues. It was about the time he spent in college. I really liked it. But the problem I had with it was Clark Kent's a college student, and he's dressed just like he did in the regular series, and he just had this grandfatherly demeanor. You know, whereas the other characters, there was a guy with a long hair and a beard called Ducky, and it was one of his friends. And the whole time these people are arguing and doing these crazy things, Clark Kent standing there grandfatherly picking something up, moving it over. I don't know. He didn't seem young or a college student. And that was a problem I was starting to have with Kurt Swan. I loved the last two issues of Action Comics and Superman that Alan Moore wrote and George Perez inked. And Kurt Swan drew them, but they were greatness. But,
there was a few issues of Superman or Action that Al Williamson was inking over Kurt Swan, and they were just absolutely beautiful. Kurt Swan got stuck with inkers that were good inkers, but they just were old-fashioned inkers like David Hunt and people like that. His art was solid. It was always solid. Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. He was never a Kirby-style artist. He was in the old style where it would just be, nothing would be popping out at you. It wouldn't be like flashy. It was just straightforward, good, solid storytelling. And to me, it was like, the guy I thought was, you're talking about superficiality, the guy I always thought his art was superficial, even though I like it now, was Grell. I always thought Mike Grell was weak drawing and nice cross-hatching and line work or whatever. You know, that's the way I always felt about him. And I still, to this day, I kind of see it. But his drawing's a lot better. But I've seen sketches by him that the drawing's weak. I mean, it's out of proportion, and the feet are too big, or I don't know, something.
Well, him is, the best thing was, I loved his inking.
Yeah,
he had a flashy inking style.
Yeah, flashy inking style, that's what he did.
I read The Warlord, that was my favorite comic when I was in high school. And I really enjoyed it for the first couple of years. And then they put Vince Coletta on inking it.
Well,
the problem was, it was a monthly book. He couldn't, keep up with it. So he was writing and drawing it. And I was just getting extremely upset that Vince Coletta was inking that book. He was just trashing it. And, Mike Grell, even as a kid, I used to see some odd perspective and this and that. There was a guy at a convention, he was an animator, and he had a few comics on his desk he was trying to sell. Just he had them, and he didn't know. He said, "I don't know why I ever bought this." And it was the first issue of Warlord. And he opened the book up, and people were kind of talking about it. And he says, "Well, I never thought I'd ever say I'd see a bad Neil Adams, but this is one of them."
Yep.
Well, Mike Grell liked Neil Adams. I actually found Mike Grell really interesting, and I always sought him out when I was a kid. And what was really strange is when he went to First, and I think it was on John Sable, he stopped inking it. It was just directly from his pencils.
Nicer.
But the ink was, to me, what made him who he was. I'd have enjoyed it better if he would have inked somebody else, but anyway.
Yeah, no, the thing about him was that I liked, what was the one that he did that had the, it was before, I think it was by Pacific Comics, that the backup ended up being...
Oh, he's doing Star Slayer.
Star Slayer, and the backup was the Rocketeer. Yeah, that was a classic one.
Yeah, and then he went on and went to First and did John Sable Freelance.
Did that for a long time.
You know, the Warlord was supposed to be with Atlas Comics.
Oh, yeah.
I heard him in an interview. I never knew that, but he said that, I guess Martin Goodman was the one that started Atlas.
Yeah.
And he was trying to find talent, and they were trying to get Mike Grell and see he could own his work. And so he was going to bring, I don't think it was going to be called Warlord, but it was basically that strip. And he was taking it in, and I guess before he went, it, you know, went bankrupt. And
yeah, they only lasted like a few months. They tried to glut the market, and then they got killed by Marvel.
Yeah, did Marvel sue them or anything?
No, they just started putting out so many titles, and it was like you. I remember going to to the newsstand, seeing all these new characters, and then 3 months later they were gone. Because yeah. I think he tried to do too much too fast or whatever.
Well, those comics were everywhere, and I remember sometimes people at school would have them, and it didn't seem like anybody really reading them with any enthusiasm. It just kind of, here.
And, they did everything. They did the comic books, they did the magazines. They had all sorts of crap, too. You know, I was real surprised. They had the Monster magazine. You know, Martin Goodman went in there and go, okay, we're going to, like, do everything. And it was maybe a little too much or whatever. I seem to remember them lasting maybe 6 or 7 months. But I remember, like, Ditko and Wood did some Tiger Man. Was it Tiger Man or was
it
some
Destroyer?
Was it Destroyer? That's right. Was it Tiger Man, Ernie Colon or whatever?
I remember seeing an issue of Tiger Man, but I never really read it. I didn't realize that Wood and Colon did those Destroyer.
Wood and Ditko.
Well, Wood and Ditko.
Yeah, oh, they're beautiful, man. Yeah,
yeah, those were kind of neat.
I remember Wood and Ditko also did that guy for DC. It was like, I can see the cover and I can't think of the name of the character. I can't think of it right now, but yeah, it was like the last gasp for some of these artists around the mid-70s. You remember when was Wood doing the All-Star Squadron 2 or whatever then?
That came a little bit later, because what was it? That was the end of 1974.
Yeah, that was it. That was at the time.
And
yeah.
All-Star Squadron was the end of 75.
That's right. He did a few issues of that, and then Joe Staton did some after that, and it was like kind of a letdown, you know, kind of, sort of, or whatever. But it's still, the Destructor, I think, was Wood and Ditko.
Yeah, because I know Wally Wood was doing work for DC, because he did the All-Star Comics, and they were making a big deal. They were bringing it back, and then he also did Hercules. I think he did Hercules.
And Hercules, so there, a lot of them were penciled by Garcia Lopez, and some were penciled by Simonson.
Yeah, Simonson.
But they were inked by Wood, so you couldn't tell. Yeah, I think it was this character called the Destructor. I think Wood inked a few of them, and then Ditko did the pencils on most of them. But yeah, okay, this one, the Destructor went up to 4 issues, which was, you know, I'm surprised that it went up that. Huh. I thought those were done like after 3 months. There you go. The Destructor, that was it. It's beautiful. Written by Archie Goodwin.
Yeah, Howard Chaykin did a book, I think, Scorpion.
The Scorpion, yeah. The Scorpion was pretty nice, too. So, anyway.
Yeah, Atlas Comics.
Yeah, 75, that was the year, I think. That was a good year, actually. Well, you know, we'll get into that later on. So what do you got there, man? What are you reading? It looks like you're reading some Mobius there.
Oh, well, I just brought... This
Shade the Changing Man is the one that I think.
That was a DC.
Yeah, that was a DC.
Michael Fleischer
Ditko and
wrote
Wood
it.
Do that?
No, well, Ditko did it. I don't remember Wood.
He inked one. Okay.
Yeah, Michael Fleischer wrote it. And that was neat. And I didn't read them. I got one issue, and I guess it was like the third or fourth. And I wanted to read it, but I just missed the other ones. And I couldn't quite tell exactly what was going on. And I guess he had a force field that would, you know.
Yeah.
It would kind of distort part of his body.
Yeah. It was typical Ditko.
Yeah, and it seemed like, like the old Doctor Strange stuff, which I loved.
Yeah, with the fingers pointing.
That's Ditko. The Doctor Strange stuff is my favorite Ditko work. It's just the ones I love the most.
That was pretty druggy stuff, man, let me tell you, you know.
Walt Simonson was talking about Steve Ditko created a whole new language using all those vectors for the magical powers.
Yeah.
And he said nobody had done it before, and nobody's really done it since. And I know when him and Marty Pascal did that Doctor Strange special for DC, he was trying to come up with another way to show the powers. He's using the Ankh, which was a Dr. Fate symbol. But he was trying to do that. He says, excuse me. But he said, I kind of failed on that, I think. But, Steve Ditko was something. But yeah, the Shade the Changing, man, every once in a while I'll find an issue in some cutout box and pick it up. And
sure.
It was, I think it was Alan Gold or Mike Gold.
Mike Gold, I think, is the guy who drew
I guess Alan Gold was the singer.
No, that guy who did Andrew Gold did Lonely Boy.
Oh, Andrew Gold.
Andrew Gold, yeah.
And he said the thank you for being a friend, too, right?
That's right. He did do that, too. Yeah.
What's the use for the Golden Girls?
That's right, the Golden Girls.
But, what do you call it? Mike Gold, when they canceled that first comic, Mars, which I really liked.
Which one?
Mars. Mark Hempel and Mark Wheatley.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember now.
That was one of my favorite comics in the 80s. They did 12 issues, which was nice. I think it was 12.
Pretty sure.
But it was something. And all of a sudden they wrapped it up and canceled it. And I was disappointed. And he was, you know, Mike Gold was writing a write-up about it. He says, well, he went through the same thing when he was an editor at DC and had to cancel Shade the Changing Man.
Mm.
And he was talking about what a unique comic book it was and how much he enjoyed doing it. And it was just, there was nothing else like it. So nevertheless, people didn't buy it. And so he had to cancel it, but he never regretted ever doing it.
Right.
And he says, I feel the same way about this one. It was a unique comic. I enjoyed it quite a bit, and there was nothing else like it. But he said it just wasn't selling enough, and they were canceling, but he had no regrets. So
that's cool.
Anyway, no, what we're talking about, just some of the comics going out, I picked this one up. It's a Cartoon Network show called Adventure Time.
Desmond was talking about this book.
Well, my daughter is a huge fan of the show. I watch it. I like it quite well. The other day I was at home and I started watching some episodes. It's pretty unique and fun.
What's Kaboom?
It's a company. They put those out there. I think they put some other stuff out too, but the Adventure Time comic, I've seen them whenever I go visit my daughter in Tallahassee. And they're nice looking. A lot of times in the past when there was a licensed comic, it was always hacked out, you know. This one, it looks like the cartoon. But this one's funny. The main character in the cartoon is a guy named Finn with the bunny ears and his dog named Jake. Well, I saw one episode of Adventure Time, and instead of Finn, it's a girl named Fiona. You know, same thing. And then the dog is a cat named Cake instead of Jake. I thought it was funny. All the people were reversed. The princess was a prince. You know, if you're a guy in the regular comic, you're a girl in it. Well, it was funny. And anyway, I saw that issue. I guess it's 1 of 6, and I bought it. It's absolutely beautiful. It's well drawn. It's it's just fantastic how they told the story.
It looks nice.
Yeah, it's written and illustrated by Natasha Legre.
And it looks like it's for kids, which is rare.
Yeah, well, it's a cartoon show that kids can like, you know, or kids like, but adults can enjoy it too. And I've heard people talk about the Adventure Time comic, but they got more than one series. It's several. But I heard on some other podcast this guy was talking about it. And basically one of the main characters in it that Finn hangs out with is Princess Bubblegum. And she's a princess made out of bubblegum. And her kingdom, everybody's candy. You know, I mean, there's just, you know, everybody is some piece of candy. Like, you kind of look here, you know. But in this, the princess is a prince. And there's different groups. There's a girl that's a vampire in the regular series. There's a Ice King. There's
You know what it is? It's the coloring is really pretty.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful book. But somebody's telling me in the regular series, or one of the series, they're basically talking about it's the world after some type of a nuclear holocaust, and Finn is the only human remaining alive. Which in the cartoon show, he is the only human. Everybody else is some type of creature. And but it's just, it's fun.
That's kind of a drag.
Well, but I just find the comic kind of unique that a lot of times when you're doing a licensed comic for a cartoon show, I guess it's kind of like doing a Star Trek. It's not canon. It's not anything that goes with it, so you can't be innovative. But the comic book, they're really getting far out there telling some of these stories. And
It says here in the back of the Next Month in Adventure Comics, it says incentive covers. I guess this is like different covers or rare covers. One of them's by Stephanie Buscema. His granddaughter is a real good artist.
Exactly.
But she draws completely different from John or whatever. She's got her own website, and it's pretty nice.
Yeah, actually. She does really nice work.
Yeah, like 50s looking or, you know, retro looking stuff or whatever.
But Kaboom, I guess, to me, is kind of like Harvey Comics.
yeah, it looks like it. I'm wondering if they're like connected with a bigger company, you know what I mean? Like a major movie studio or something.
Well, they've
like
been
that.
Around. I've seen other stuff they've done. But
let's see.
But I love that opening sequence there about the girl with the fire.
Well, it's got Cartoon Network on it. I'm wondering if does Cartoon Network have their own comic book line or something?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But well, Adventure Time
we'll
is
investigate.
A cartoon. Adventure Time is a Cartoon Network show.
Okay.
Anyway, and you bought this one as well,
Mars Attacks
Popeye
with
Popeye.
Beautiful art by Terry Beatty.
Well, like I said, I'm a sucker for Popeye. I was never a huge fan of the Mars Attacks. I like seeing them when Wally Wood drew them. I just don't really care for the painting finishes. But they have a line of comics where it's Mars Attacks and then somebody else. Kiss, I think, is in one.
Yeah, they're going against Kiss and a few other. They did it for like a month, I think, every week. The incentive covers were almost better than some of them. Like, they had like Raj 2000, Mars Attack,
and
Manhunter,
Star Slammers.
Or yeah. Star Slammers, Mars Attacks. Yeah.
yeah, that was and Miss Fury from Jay Bone.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Judge Dredd. Yeah, I thought, wow, what? But they were just incentive covers. But Al and I picked Mars Attacks versus Popeye. I wasn't crazy about the cover. I'd seen the cover. It looks like an old Mars Attacks bubblegum card. I'd seen it online. But the interior of this is one of the greatest Popeye comics I have ever read. Terry Beatty drew it. Tell me a little bit about Terry Beatty. You seem to know.
Mystery. Remember Mystery from back in the old days? From, I think, was it First Comics? I know it was for
Eclipse.
DC. Eclipse, yeah. But then he went to DC and did, remember Wild Dog?
Oh yeah.
That's Terry Beatty too. Yeah, Wild Dog.
Well, the guy that wrote it was they both did Dick Tracy together too, right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, it was Max Allen Collins.
Oh, he did Miss Tree too.
Yeah, that's right.
They were a team.
Yeah, because Max Allen Collins now is a big time mystery writer, and Terry Beatty does. I don't know. I mean, besides that, the only thing I've ever seen from him in the last few years was he does the covers for Scary Monsters, the Monster Movie magazine. Beautiful covers, too.
Well, you mentioned Wild Dog. I remember Wild Dog was in Action Comics when they made it the big anthology.
Yeah, the anthology. And Kurt Swan had stories in that. I remember Dead Man. Yeah, that was a cool book, actually.
And Blackhawk. I remember Mike Grell wrote it.
That's right.
And somebody else drew it.
Oh, God, who drew that? I can't remember. It wasn't Cockrum, was it?
No.
Okay.
But it was funny because like I said, I always thought of Mike Grell as an artist, even though he wrote stuff, but it was kind of strange to see him write for somebody else. I thought it was pretty good because the strip started out with a Blackhawk complaining that Milton Caniff was leaving Terry and the Pirates to start some comic strip called Steve Canyon, which was a commercial transport pilot. And he's yelling, oh, that'll be just as interesting as, you know, somebody doing your taxes. And I just thought, that's kind of clever. But, no, the Mad Dog strip, I remember that really well because in Comics Journal, I think it was Gary Groth was ripping into him hard.
Okay, yeah, here we go. Blackhawk was, I think it was Rick Burkett and Pablo Marcos. They're the ones who did the Blackhawk. Yeah, there was I think, Dead Man by Dan Jurgens and Tony DeZuniga. Wasn't there a Blackhawk book drawn by Dan Spiegel?
It could have been.
I'm pretty sure that DC did it back in the 80s and stuff like that. Yeah, you're right. And Max Allen Collins, Terry Beatty, and John Nyberg did Wild Dog. Yeah, that was it. That's a character they haven't brought back yet, but yeah.
Well, I just remember Gary Groth, basically, when he did some review on that book, he ripped Wild Dog down one side and up the other, and he was brutal with it. As
yeah,
he
I remember.
Usually is. But I'm guessing it was, I don't know if it was Terry Beatty. He wrote into the Comics Journal. I said, come on, Gary, I'm just trying to make a fun comic. And I guess it started being a back and forth. And of course, you know, Gary Groth was no pulled punches. And at one point, the same person wrote again, you know, kind of complaining and pleading with him. And then his girlfriend wrote Gary Groth and was basically saying, I can't believe what you're doing. So to keep it going, Gary Groth wrote up a contest that says, I'm not Terry Beatty, nor am I his girlfriend. And you're supposed to write a letter in saying this and that. I never saw any more after that, but whenever I see Wild Dog, I remember that.
Gary Groth, I don't know about him now, but he used to be kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Comics Journal was kind of like an obnoxious magazine there for a while, but I don't know about now.
No. Yeah,
they were really ripping on mainstream comic books, you know, and it's kind of, you know, that's fine and dandy, you know, but, you know, the stuff Fantagraphics was doing, some of it was good, but some of it was not that great. And when they started going into all porn or whatever, it was just like, okay.
Well, and that was the big joke, was he was ripping on people for doing other stuff, and then he was doing the same thing. And I guess there was an interview where somebody brought that up, and then a contradiction, and he just laughed. He knew it was. Cause
of course. He
was doing the porn comics. He was doing monster comics. I think he even had a line of superhero comics.
He did. He had everything for a while there. They were on the black and white era.
Well, they had to make money, because I guess he was, you know, that's one thing. That company was...
Eros was their company. Eros.
But I think he was basically trying to scratch his way out of, you know, keep him from going into oblivion.
I think now the Comics Journal comes out as like some kind of a quarterly hardcover or something like that.
Yeah, well, I know they stopped doing the magazine, and it's actually a really nice website.
And for a while there, I have a few. They were doing this really giant, oversized book. I have one that's like tributes to some of the old, like Russ Heath, Frazetta, or whatever. It was a big, oversized book, but I think now it's just a hardcover that comes out every once in a while.
Well, I'll tell you, it was a great magazine, and I remember in the late 80s, to me, there was nothing better than that. I love getting the Comics Journal and reading all the articles. And
the interviews.
Yeah, one of them, when Jeff Smith was doing Bone, you know, to a lot of people, like myself, Bone just kind of appeared out of nowhere and was an overnight success.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had a really beautiful cover by Jeff Smith on it, and Gary Groth did the interview. And that was kind of funny, because I thought, really, Gary Groth is going to interview this guy? Because, you know, Bone, it looked like a sweet kids comic, you know. And when they're doing the write-up at the beginning, introducing the thing, they said, you know, to most people, Jeff Smith just kind of appeared with Bone out of nowhere. And they said, it's a really successful comic, has done this and that. And it says, we thought we'd, you know, bring the guy in and interview and find out a little bit more about him. And so, of course, I know a lot of people are starting to see that, you know, Gary Groth is interviewing Jeff Smith is almost like, you know, a guy with a bloody club over a little tiny baby seal, which is what I thought. And he says, you'll find Jeff Smith actually holds his own and answers quite well. And it was a really good interview. It was, you know, mutual respect and this and that. I remember one point when Jeff Smith, he was in animation, had an animation studio. And then it wasn't working out, and he took what money he had, started doing Bone. And it wasn't selling as well. You know, he was trying to make it. And he said at one point he had so much money left. So what he did was he went and bought a suit. And then he had the first three issues. He reprinted enough copies. And he went to, I don't know, some dealer's convention or whatever for comics. Set up a table. And he printed up enough copies to give the first three issues to every single dealer and, you know, store owner and everything. And, you know, he met with everybody, wore the suit, talked and all that. Smartest thing he ever did. Because after that, everybody read it, and he said, I figured if I could get them on the first three issues, they'd want to know what happened. And that's absolutely what happened. And they all ordered it and went on. Pretty smart guy. But he was talking about, you know, his first start, and he just kept praying, please, just 30,000. That's all I'm asking, just 30,000.
30,000 is like an incredible print run now.
Well, we're talking back 80s. In the early 90s, you know.
Yeah.
But he's seen Gary Groth start to laugh, and he says, yeah, I hear you. I feel your pain. But you got to remember, too, the comics weren't as expensive per issue as they are now. So, you know, 30,000, you weren't making that big of a print run.
I just remember the infamous, and I have it, too, somewhere, the infamous Gary Groth interview with Harlan Ellison. That was the one that turned me off big time.
Yeah, well,
where Harlan Ellison rips on Don Heck and everybody, whatever.
Oh yeah, well, he didn't pull any punches, and sometimes I think you just get mean to get mean.
Yeah.
Ken Brusniak, you know, the guy that did the lettering for Our Chicken, he was on a sidebar talking about He worked for Steranko. Steranko had a house, and his whole staff.
Fantagraphics, you know. Preview magazine.
Yeah,
Preview.
But it was Preview magazine and
Preview or Media Scene.
It started out as Media Scene and turned into Preview. But Gary Groth lived there. He was one of the staff, and so was Ken Brusniak. And he said at one point Gary Groth was aiming a loaded gun at Ken Brusniak. And he says he thought it was funny.
That's crazy.
And Ken Brusniak, I guess, didn't think so. And I thought, well, yeah, that kind of explains so much.
Jeez.
But he's actually really interesting. I don't know if he's like that in person, or if he's just in reality, or if he's just setting up a character.
In text, he probably seems that way. Maybe
he probably made himself that way to sell more stuff.
Because it's funny how sometimes you write on an email, you write in text, and you don't get the inflection or the facial gesture, and it sounds worse than it really is.
Yeah, it's happened to me.
It's happened to me, too. Yeah, so there you go.
But back to Popeye Mars Attacks. This is fantastic. I'll tell you, Terry Beatty can draw just like the old Popeye strip, and he can also draw the Martians. I never would have thought that Popeye and the Mars Attacks Martians would have gone together, but by golly, they do. This is one of my favorite comics. Have you read the other Mars Attacks books?
No, I just got that one. I ain't getting the other ones.
Yeah, well, if you got to get one, this is the one to get. And Popeye fights giant robots. That's
awesome, dude. I love giant robots.
Yeah.
Especially Johnny Sacco and his flying and his giant robot. Remember that?
So, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff out now that I really like. It's just sometimes it's hard to find.
Yeah, so. we better, we're already at the 49-minute mark. So we better get this.
You were telling me, listening to the show, you were telling me about somebody you wanted to play.
Yeah, let's do some Alex Chilton at the end here. I've always wanted to play him. I keep forgetting to. He passed away last year, and he's kind of like one of the rock and roll unsung heroes. For a lot of reasons. You know, he never really he was the lead singer of the Box Tops, but then he quit, and he kind of had a kind of a ragged career, but he did a lot of cool music, and he's very well respected, and basically he was one of these guys that just did whatever he wanted to do, and he didn't give a crap what you thought of it, so that's always good. And we'll just end the show. We'll just end up playing one of his songs. I don't know which one it's going to be, but whatever one it is, we'll post it on the blog there.
And that'll be it till episode 50. See you later.
Got a hit record now. Pockets just full of dough. Got some new clothes too. And good shoes on my feet. Penthouse apartment. Icebox just full of good things to eat. Can dance, wear Ivy League clothes too. Ain't no cuffs in my pants. Gotta keep a $50 process. Hair just straight as silk. Manicure and facial. and just softly buttermilk. And on my finger is a diamond ring. Two chicks on each arm, and boys, I'm ready to swing. Yes, I'm ready. Making love. Making love. I feel so good. Money in my pocket. Are you ready, baby?